21, and taken a prestigious sinecure at the U.S. Office of Naval Research. Then at 23, had been court-martialed out of the ONR for offenses that changed each time you asked him. Some event between 21 and 23 seemed to have broken him at several strategic points, and he'd retreated from Bethesda back to the front stoop of his old Roxbury Crossing apartment building, where he read Baha'i texts whose jackets he covered with intricately folded newspaper, and spat spectacular parabolas of quivering phlegm into New Dudley Street. He was dark-freckled and carbuncular and afflicted with excess phlegm. He was an incredible spitter, and alleged his missing incisors had been removed for facilitating the expectoratory process. We all suspected he was either hypomanic or dreen-addicted or both. His expression was very serious at all times. He discoursed non-stop to poor Brant, using spit as a sort of conjunction between clauses. He spoke loudly because they both wore earplugs of expanding foam. People's nightmare cries gave them the fantods. Their custodial technique consisted of Kenkel spitting with pinpoint accuracy onto whatever surface Brant was to clean next, and Brant, trotting like a fine hunting dog from glob to glob, listening and grinning, laughing when appropriate. They were moving away from me down the hall toward the second floor's east window, Brant making great shining arcs with his doll's head mop, Kenkel pulling the gunmetal bucket and lobbing signifying phlegm over Brant's bent back.
"And then the Yuletide season, Brant, my friend, Brant, Christmas, Christmas morning. What is the essence of Christmas morning but the childish coeval of venereal interface for a child? A present, Brant. Something you have not earned and which formerly was out of your possession is now in your possession. Can you sit there and try to say there is no symbolic relation between unwrapping a Christmas present and undressing a young lady?"
Brant bobbed and mopped, uncertain whether to laugh. Himself had met Kenkel and Brant on the tee. Kenkel and Brant apparently rode the tee at night, recreationally, trying somehow to make it up to Enfield from the Back Bay via the Orange Line,
353,
and somewhat the worse for wear. Kenkel and Brant not only got himself onto the right color train and kept him propped up between them all the way up the eternity of Commonwealth Avenue, they'd seen him safely down the T-stop's steep iron stairs, and across traffic, and up the hill's serpentine driveway to the portcullis, and had been invited in, at 0200, by himself, to continue whatever low-temperature discussion he and Kenkel had been having, as Brant carried himself up the hill in a fireman's carry. Kenkel recalls that night's discussion being about the human nose as an erectile organ. But the only real sure bet is that it was one-sided. And the duo had ended up being cast as black-veiled, no-style attendants in himself's zero-gravity tea ceremony, and had been menially employed at ETA ever since, though always on the graveyard shift, since Mr. Hardy loathed Kenkel with a passion. Kenkel hawked and hit a small strip of dust at the crease of baseboard and floor that the mop's arc had missed.
"For I'm a missionary man, Brant, is what I am. Brant, as in give me the straightforward venereal interface of missionary congress or give me nihil and zilch. You know what I'm saying? Give me your best thoughts on alternative positions, Brant. Brant, for me, for my part at least, I say nix and nihil on the rear entry or you might hear it termed dog or canine style interface, so favored in huts, blue cartridges, tantric etchings. Brant, it's animalistic."
"Why? Why, you say? Brant, it is an essentially hunched way to have interface. She hunches, you hunch over her. Inordinately too much hunching, to my own way of..."
It was Brant who heard me as I came up behind them in socks, trying to keep to the drier patches. I almost slipped twice. It was still coming down hard outside the east window.
"Otto Brant here,"
Brant called to me, extending a hand, though I was still several meters away. Kenkel's dreadlocks protruded from under a plaid hat. He turned with Brant and raised his hand Indianishly in greeting.
"Good Prince Hal, up and dressed in dawns early."
"Let me introduce myself," Brant said,
I shook his hand.
It is socks and toothbrush, ETA's Atheling, Brant, whom I will wager rarely hunches.
The darkness needs you guys upstairs ASAP, I said, trying to dry a sock against a pant leg. Dark's face is stuck to the window and he's in terrible pain and we couldn't pull it off, and it's going to take hot water, but not too hot. I indicated the bucket at Kenkel's feet. I noticed Kenkel's shoes didn't match.
What may we ask is so amusing, then? Kenkel asked.
Name's Brant, and pleased to meet you,
Brant said, out with a hand again. He dropped them off where Kenkel pointed.
Trolch is with him now, but he's in a bad way, I said, shaking Brant's hand.
We are en route, Kenkel said. But why the hilarity?
What hilarity?
Kenkel looked from me to Brant to me.
What hilarity, he says. Your face is a hilarity face. It's working hilariously. At first it merely looked amused. Now it is openly catchinated. You are almost doubled over. You can barely get your words out. You're all but slapping your knee. That hilarity, good Prince Atheling Howe. I thought all you players were compadre mundos in civilian life.
Brant beamed as he backed down the hall. Kenkel pushed his plaid cap back to scratch at some sort of eruption at the hairline. I drew myself up to full height and consciously composed my face into something deadly somber. How about now? Brant had the custodial closet unlocked. There was the sound of a metal bucket being filled at the closet's industrial tap. Kenkel brought his cap back forward and narrowed his eyes at me. He came up close. His eyelashes were clotted with small, crisp, yellow flakes. There were struck-like facial cysts in various stages of development. Kenkel's breath always smelled vaguely of egg salad. He felt at his mouth speculatively for a moment and said,
"Somewhere's now between amused and catchinated. Mirthful, perhaps. The crinkled eyes, the dimples of mirth, the exposed gums. We can bounce this off Brant's best thinking as well if..."
From directly overhead came a ceiling, rattling,
"Yeah!"
from Stice. I was feeling at my face. Some doors opened along the hall, heads protruding. Brant had a full metal bucket and was trying to run to the stairwell, the weight of the bucket canting his shoulder and steaming water sloshing onto the clean floor. He stopped with his hand on the stairwell door and looked back over his shoulder at us, reluctant to proceed without Kenkel.
"I elect to go with Mirthful,"
Kenkel said, giving my shoulder a little squeeze as he stepped past. I heard him saying different things to the heads in the doorways all the way down the hall.
"Jesus," I said.
Socks or no, I went forward into the really wet mopped area and tried to make out my face's expression in the east window. It was now too light, though, outside, off all the snow. I looked sketchy and faint to myself, tentative and ghostly against all that blazing white.
Partial transcript of weather-delayed meeting between 1. Mr. Rodney Tyne Sr., Chief of Unspecified Services and White House Advisor on Interdependent Relations. 2. Ms. Maureen Hooley, Vice President for Children's Entertainment, Interlace, Tell Entertainment, Inc. 3. Mr. Carl E. Buster Yee, Director of Marketing and Product Perception, Glad Flaccid Receptacle Corporation. 4. Mr. R. Tyne Jr., Deputy Regional Coordinator, U.S. Office of Unspecified Services. And 5. Mr. P. Tom Veals, Viney and Veals Advertising Unlimited, 8th Floor State House Annex, Boston, Massachusetts, USA. 20th of November, Year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. Mr. Tyne Sr.
Tom, Buster, Mo.
Mr. Veals.
The G.
Mr. Yee.
Rod.
Mr. Tyne Sr.
Guys.
Mr. Tyne Jr.
Afternoon, Chief.
Mr. Tyne Sr. Miss Hooley.
Glad you could finally get in, Rod. May I say we're all extremely excited on our end.
Mr. Tyne Sr.
Never seen snow like this. Any of you ever seen snow remotely approaching anything like this?
Mr. Veals sneezes.
Fucking town.
Mr. Yee.
like an extra dimension out there. Less an element than its own dimension.
Someone, shoes making a squelching noise under the table.
Mr. Yi, with its own rules, laws, awe-inspiring, fearsome.
Mr. Veals,
cold, wet, deep, slippery, more like.
Mr. Tyne Jr., tapping the edge of a ruler against the tabletop.
Their limo in from Logan did a 180 on Starro. Mr. Yi was just telling.
Mr. Tyne Sr., tapping a telescoping weatherman's pointer against the edge of the tabletop.
So what's the poop? The skinny. What are we talking?
Ms. Hooley. Spot ready for previewing. We need your go. I'm in from Phoenix via New York.
Mr. Yi. I'm in from Ohio, choppered up from New York with Mo here.
Miss Hooley. Spot's master's in the post-production lab down at V&V, already except for some final bugs with the matting.
Mr. Veals. Moraine says we need you and Busta's green light to disseminate.
Ms. Hooley. You and the titular sponsor here greenlight it. We can have disseminatable product by the end of the weekend.
Mr. Veals sneezes. Assuming this fucking snow doesn't shut down our power.
Mr. Tyne Sr., motioning with weatherman's pointer to USO stenographer to transcribe verbatim.
Seen it yet, Buster?
Mr. Yi. Negative, Rod. Just in with these folks here. Kennedy completely socked in. Mo had a charter or chopper. I'm sitting here cherry.
Mr. Tyne Jr., tapping edge of ruler on tabletop.
How'd you fare getting up here, sir, if I may?
Mr. Tyne Sr.
Mountain comes to Mohammed, eh, Tom?
Mr. Veals.
How come I only came 2 clicks down here and I'm the one with the fucking cold?
Mr. Tyne Jr.
I've been here in Boston as well.
Mr. Veals, checking connections on Infernitron 210Y digital player and viewer system.
So, shall we?
Mr. Tyne Sr.
Okay, for the record, Mo. Demographic target?
Ms. Hooley. Ages 6 to 10 with marginally reduced efficacy, 4 to 6, and 10 to 13. Let's say targets 4 to 12, white, native English-speaking, median income and above, capacity on Kruger abstraction scale 3 or above, refers to notes. Advertible attention span of 16 seconds, with a geometric fall-off commencing at 13 seconds. Mr. Tyne Sr.
Spot length?
Ms. Hooley. 30 seconds with a traumatic graphic at 14 seconds.
Mr. Veals.
Hawks phlegm.
Mr. Yi. Proposed insertion vehicle, Mo?
Ms. Hooley. The Mr. Bouncity Bounce Show, spontaneous dissemination at 1600, Monday to Friday, 1500 Central and Mountain. Cream of the crop. 82 share on spontaneous receptions for the slot.
Mr. Yi.
Any data on what percentage of total viewing in the slot is spontaneous versus recorded cartridge?
Miss Hooley. We had 47% plus or minus 2 as of year of the You Shit You 2007. That's the last year the data's firmed up for.
Mr. Tyne Sr.
So, say 40% of total viewing for the spot.
Mr. Yi.
Give or take. Impressive.
Mr. Tyne Sr.
So, check, check, check. We got rough costs?
Mr. Yi.
Production just over half a meg. Post-production,
Mr. Veals.
Bupkis, 150K before matting.
Mr. Yi.
I might add that Tom's pro bonoing his part of the production.
Mr. Veals.
So, you all ready to eyeball this or what?
Miss Hooley. Since Mr. BB's contracted as a no public service spot vehicle, dissemination charge will come out around 180K per slot.
Mr. Yi.
Which we're still of the position, this seems a bit steep.
Mr. Tyne Jr.
The upcoming year's GLAAD's year, Buster. You wanted the year. You want the year of GLAAD to be the year half the nation stopped doing anything but staring bug-eyed at some sinister cartridge while little whirls went around in their eyes until they died of starvation in the middle of their own excre...
Mr. Tyne Sr.
Shut up, Rodney. And quit with the ruler tapping. Buster, I'm sure, knows the incredible goodwill that's even now accruing from their proud sponsorship of probably the most important public service spots ever conceived, given the potential threat here.
Mr. Veals sneezes twice in abrupt succession, comment unintelligible. Mr. Tyne Sr. taps telescoping weatherman's pointer on edge of tabletop.
Righto, then. The spot itself, then. The spokesfigure icon thing. Still the, singing Kleenex?
Mr. Yee.
The what was it, Frankie the no thanky hanky? Warning kids to say no thanky to unlabeled or suspicious cartridges?
Ms. Hooley clears throat. Tom? Mr. Tyne Jr. taps ruler on edge of tabletop. Mr. Veals hawks.
No! Had to shit-can the dancing Kleenex after the response group's test data were analyzed. Various problems. The phrase, no thanky, itself perceived as archaic, uncool, crotchety adult. Too New England or something. Summoned images of a leathery-faced old guy in overalls. Took attention away from what they're supposed to say no thanks to. Plus, phrase recognition data was way under minimum slogan parameters.
Ms. Hooley. Problems with the icon itself. Mr. Veals, blowing nose one nostril at a time.
Kids hated Frankie the Hanky. We're talking levels past ambivalence. Associated the hanky with snot, basically. The word booger kept coming up. The singing didn't help.
Miss Hooley. Which is why in this case, thank God for response group testing.
Mr. Yee. This business will make you old.
Mr. Veals.
Had to go back and completely reboot at square one.
Mr. Yee.
Does anyone else smell a peculiar citrusy floral odor?
Miss Hooley. Tom's boys have been at it 24/7. We're extremely excited at the result.
Mr. Veals. It's previewable but rough. Not really quite there yet. The first Phil's digitals had a bug.
Mr. Tyne Jr.
Phil?
Mr. Veals.
A small bug, but nasty. Dregs of a turbo virus in the graphic encoder. Phil's head kept detaching and floating off to the upper right. Not a good effect at all, given the message we want to send.
Mr. Yee.
Like orange blossoms, but with a kind of sick sweetness.
Miss Hooley. Oh, dear.
Mr. Veals sneezes. And debugging put us behind on some of the fonts, so you're going to have to use some imagination here. Has this 210 unit been downloaded for schematic matting?
Mr. Tyne Jr.
Excuse me, Phil?
Mr. Veals.
Introducing Fully Functional Phil, the Prancing Ass.
Miss Hooley. More like a mule. A burro.
A burro!
Mr. Tyne Jr., tapping like mad.
An ass?
Miss Hooley. Horse characters were copyrighted by Child Search. They're Patch the Pony Who Says Nay to Stranger's Spots. Mr. Tyne Jr.
A prancing ass.
Miss Hooley. The perception of naivete and clumsiness about a mule icon provoked a kind of empathy in the response groups. Phil's not coming off as an authority figure joy-killer type. More like a peer. So the cartridge he warns against gets none of the forbidden fruit type boost of being warned against by an authority figure.
Mr. Veals. Plus the kid market's a friggin' horror show. Near every species was copyrighted. Garfield? McGruff the freaking crime dog? Toucan Sam? The ONAN bird of prey? Let's not even get into the bears or bunnies. It was basically either an ass or a cockroach. Never again the kids market as God is my witness.
Sneezes. Miss Hooley. Once we went with the burrow, Tom opted to accentuate the clumsy incompetence factor. To almost ironize the icon. Buck teeth, crossed eyes.
Mr. Veals. Extravagantly crossed. Like he's just been whacked with a sock full of nickels. My response was through the roof.
Miss Hooley. Ears that won't stay upright. Legs keep getting all rubbery and tangled when he tries to prance.
Mr. Veals. But prance he does.
Mr. Yee.
But surely it doesn't present itself as an ass. Surely it doesn't prance out and say, take it from me, an ass.
Mr. Veals.
A fully functional ass.
Miss Hooley. Tom's rather ingeniously played up the functionality angle. The energy and verve versus passivity angle. He's never just Phil. He's fully functional Phil. He's a blur of kid-type activity. School, playing, telepewter interfacing, prancing. Tom's got him storyboarded for a number of 30-second activity-packed little adventures. He's a goof, an iconic child, but he's active. He stands for the attraction of capacity, agency, choice. As versus the spot's animated adult who we see in a recliner, ostensibly watching the Canadian cartridge, little spirals going around and around in his eyes, as his body sort of melts, and his head starts growing and distending until the passive watching adult's image is just a huge 5 o'clock shadowed head in the recliner, his eyeballs huge and whirling. Mr. Tyne Jr. taps his ruler against the edge of the tabletop. Mr. Veals,
let's just roll the thing for him, Mo.
Mr. Tyne Sr.
I've got to say I foresee trouble selling a certain commander-in-chief on a prancing ass as an improvement over a singing Kleenex.
Ms. Hooley, Phil's message is that not every entertainment cartridge out there is necessarily a good old safe, pre-approved interlaced tele-entertainment product. He says words reached him during his fun-filled, fully functional daily activities of a certain very wicked and sneaky cartridge that even has a little smiling face on the case. And when you first start watching it, looks like it promises to be more fun to watch than anything you've ever wished on a star or blown out a birthday cake candle for. In a thought bubble that becomes visible when Phil's ears flop down again, Mr. Veals sneezes.
Not yet matted in all the way, Mr. Tyne Sr. You know how he is about Kleenex.
Miss Hooley. Will be an image of an iconic cartridge case with a friendly smile and pudgy little harmless Pillsbury Doughboy arms and legs. Mr. Yee, loosening his collar.
Not the actual copyrighted Pillsbury iconic limb animation codes, though.
Mr. Veals.
Relax, more like a reference. An allusion to plumpness, cuteness. Pudgy and harmless-looking limbs is the thing.
Mr. Tyne Jr., tapping edge of tabletop with ruler. Mr. Tyne Sr., pointing at tapping ruler with weatherman's pointer.
You're close to losing that hand, bucko.
Miss Hooley, referring to notes. Then Phil looks up and pops the thought bubble with a needle and says, But it's a liar. This smiling cartridge is a wicked thing, lying, like the stranger who leans out of his car and offers you a ride home to your mommy and daddy, but really wants to grab you and put his sweaty hand over your mouth and lock you in the car and take you far away with him to where you'll never see your mommy, daddy, or Mr. Bouncy Bounce ever again.
Mr. Veals. Which, and here's the traumatic graphic at 14, a dock-boarded new thought bubble over Phil in which now the cartridge's limbs are like a dock worker's. It's a swart, leering cartridge with yellow fangs and long nails in a plaid cap and overalls, driving off with an animated kid's plate all screaming and horrified against the car's rear window, spirals starting to roll in the kid's eyes. Wait till you see it.
Miss Hooley. It's so scary, it's positively riveting. Mr. Veals sneezes twice.
Stuff of fucking nightmares.
Mr. Yee. Falls from chair. Mr. Tyne Jr.
Holy mackerel!
Mr. Tyne Sr.
Buster! Buster!
Miss Hooley. Mr. Yee's epileptic, severe, untreatable. Happened twice on the Chopper Inn. Stress or embarrassment brings it on. He'll be back up in a minute. Just act natural when he comes back up. Mr. Yee, heels drumming on Terrazzo State House Annex floor tile. Mr. Tyne Sr.
Jesus.
Mr. Tyne Jr., tapping ruler on tabletop's edge.
Jesus W. Christ.
Mr. Tyne Sr., rising, indicating tapping ruler with extended weatherman's pointer.
All right, goddammit. Give me that thing. Give it here.
Mr. Tyne Jr.
But Chief.
Mr. Tyne Sr.
You heard me, goddammit. You know it drives me bats. You'll get it back when we're done. Drives me up the wall. Always has. What is it with you and that ruler?
Miss Hooley. Be up and back in the game in a jiff. He won't remember the fit. Just don't mention it. The embarrassment of mentioning it'll set it off again. That's why twice on the chopper. I learned the hard way. Mr. Yee.
Splar, cuck!
Mr. Veals, hawking.
For Christ's sake.
Miss Hooley, referring to notes. As the cartridge in the car in the thought bubble drives the splayed kid away, Phil prances a bit and warns that we don't even know for sure what the cartridge to watch out for is even about.
He warns that the police only know that it's something that looks like you'd really want to watch it. He says all we know is it looks really entertaining, but that it really just wants to take away your functionality. He says we know it's Canadian.
Mr. Veals, that's why the plaid cap in the traumatic graphic. Response data indicates a plaid cap with ear flaps signifies a big C to over 70% of the spot's target. The overalls drive the association home.
Miss Hooley, at 19 seconds, fully functional Phil then dances his warning dance, a Native American come breakdance type dance we're hoping will catch on among younger dancers. His rhetorical thrust is to play it functional and safe, and make sure and check with mommy and or daddy before watching any entertainment you haven't seen before, i.e. to accept no spontaneous dissemination and play no post-delivered entertainment without checking with an authority figure.
Mr. Tyne Jr.
But as a peer, more like, I'm thinking this is what I better do if I want to stay fully functional.
Mr. Yee, back upright in chair.
Somebody's mentioned the floppy ear and plastic buck teeth product tie-ins.
Mr. Tyne Jr.
Jesus, Mr. Yee, are you sure you're okay?
Miss Hooley.
Ixnay on the ancient May.
Mr. Yee, sweat-soaked, looking around.
What did he mean? He didn't mean...
Mr. Tyne Sr.
God damn it, Rodney.
Mr. Yee.
Splarg.
Falls from chair.
Miss Hooley clears throat. And finally, direly, can I say direly?
Mr. Veals.
This is at 25.35 seconds.
Miss Hooley.
Emphatically warns that if mommy and or daddy have been observed sitting in one position in front of the home's viewer for an unusually long period of time.
Mr. Veals.
Without speaking, without responding to stimuli.
Miss Hooley.
Or acting in any way unusual or distracted or creepy or spooky with respect to an entertainment on the viewer.
Mr. Veals.
We caught spooky on the last pass.
Mr. Yee.
Sklarg.
Miss Hooley.
That the fully functional kid'll never attempt to rouse them himself. And fully functional Phil leans way in a kind of fisheye lens close-up, and says, N-h-h-h-way would he ever be so dumb as to even for a second plunk himself passively down and have a look at what it is his parents are so silently, creepily engrossed by, but to vacate the premises and prance as fast as he can to get a policeman, who'll know just how to cut the premises power and help Mom and Dad.
Mr. Veals.
His trademark expression is, no ho 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 way. He works it in whenever possible.
Mr. Tyne Jr.
His equivalent to the Kleenex is, no thanky.
Mr. Tyne Sr.
We're ready to view, I think.
Mr. Yee, back in seat, necktie now wrapped all the way around neck like an aviator scarf.
Still hashing out the tie-ins with Hasbro and others.
Mr. Veals.
We're all cued and ready.
Mr. Tyne Sr.
Let's have a look at the sucker.
Miss Hooley.
Since Tom's too modest to say so, I should say that Tom's already storyboarded an extremely exciting, adolescent targeted version of fully functional Phil for music video and softcore disseminations, where Phil engages in a great deal more ironic self-parody, and in this version his trademark expression becomes, it's your ass, Ace.
Mr. Tyne Jr.
So let's have a look at the bastard.
Mr. Tyne Sr.
Kid, your job here, from here on out, is to pipe down. Now do you...
Mr. Yee.
I've been asked to say for transcription how pleased the Glad Flaccid Receptacle Corporation is, during this potentially grave interval, to be a proud...
Mr. Veals, at the Infernitron 210 viewer.
Hit those lights over behind you, kid.
Mr. Tyne Jr.
This will make it difficult for the transcriber to transcribe, can I say?
Mr. Yee.
This spot doesn't happen to in any way optically pulse or strobe, does it?
Mr. Veals.
Are we all set?
Mr. Tyne Sr.
So lights already.
Gately's memories of Cheers' Nom now are clearer and vivider than any memory of the Wraith dream or the whirling wraith who said death was just everything outside you getting really slow. The implication that there might, at any given time, in any room, be whole swarms of wraiths flitting around the hospital on errands,
that couldn't affect anybody living, all way too fast to see, and dropping by to watch Gately's chest rise and fall at the rate of the sun. None of this has sunk in enough to give him the howlers, not in the wake of Joelle's visit and the fantasies of romance and rescue, and the consequent shame. There's now a sandy sound of gritty, sleetish stuff, wind-driven, against the room's window. The hiss of the heater, sounds of gunfire and brass bands from cartridge viewers on in other rooms. The room's other beds still empty and tightly made. The intercom gives that triple ding every few minutes. He wonders if they just do it to bug people. The fact that he couldn't even finish Ethan Frum in 10th grade English and hasn't got clue one about where ghost words like sinistral or Liebestod mean or come from, much less onomatophoric, is just starting to percolate up to awareness when there's a cold hand on his good shoulder and he opens his eyes. Not to mention ghost words, which is a real and esoteric word. He's been floating just under sleep's lid again. Joelle Van D's gone. The hand is the nurse that had changed the catheter bag. She looks hassled and unserene, and one cheekbone sticks out farther than the other, and her little slot of a mouth's got little vertical wrinkles all around it from being held tight all the time, not unlike the basically late Mrs. G's tight little mouth.
"The visitor said you requested this because of the tube."
It's a little stenographic notebook and Bic.
"Are you left-handed?"
The nurse means sinistral. She's penguin-shaped and smells of cheap soap. The notebook is stenographic because its pages turn over at the top instead of to the side. Gately shakes his head gingerly and opens his left hand for the stuff. It makes him feel good all over again that Joelle had understood what he'd meant. She hadn't just come to tell her troubles to somebody that couldn't make human judgment noises. Shaking his head slowly lets him see past the nurse's white hip. Ferocious Francis is sitting in the chair that the Wraith and Ewell and Calvin Thrust had all sat in, his skinny legs uncrossed, gnarled and crew-cutted and clear-eyed behind his glasses and totally relaxed, holding his portable O2 tank, his chest rising and falling at about the rate of phone rings, watching the nurse waddle tensely out. Gately can see a clean white T under the open buttons of Ferocious Francis's flannel shirt. Coughing is FF's way of saying hello.
"Still sucking air, I see,"
Ferocious Francis says when the fit's passed, making sure the little blue tubes are still taped under his nose. Gately struggles with one hand to flip the notebook open and write "Yo" in block caps, except there's nothing to really hold the notebook up against and write. He has to sort of balance it flat on one thigh so he can't see what he's writing, and writing with his left hand makes him feel like a stroke victim must feel. And what he holds up at his sponsor looks more like "you."
"Figured God needed a little help the other night, did you?"
Francis says, leaning way out to the side to get a red bandana hanky out of a back pocket.
"What I heard."
Gately tries to shrug, can't, smiles weakly. His right shoulder is so thickly bandaged, it looks like a turbaned head. The old man probes a nostril and then examines the hanky with interest, just like the dream wraith did. His fingers are swollen and misshapen, and his nails are long and square and the color of old turtle shell.
"Poor sick bastard going around cutting up people's pets. Cut up the wrong people's pets. This is the way I heard it."
Gately wants to tell Ferocious Francis how he's discovered how no 1 second of even unnarcotized post-trauma infection pain is unendurable, that he can abide if he must. He wants to share his experience with his crocodile sponsor, and plus, now that somebody he trusts himself to need is here, Gately wants to weep about the pain and tell how bad the pain of it is, how he doesn't think he can stand it 1 more second.
"You saw yourself as in charge. Thought you'd step in, protect your fellow man from his consequences. Which poor sick green ended house fuck was it?"
Gately struggles to try and get his knee up so he can see to write. Lentz, white wig, always north, always on phone. Again, it looks cuneiform, though. Illegible. Ferocious Francis blows out a nostril and replaces the little tube. The tank in his lap makes no sound. It has a little valve, but no dial or needles.
You stepped in against 6 armed Hawaiians, I hear. Marshall Plan, Captain Courageous, God's personal Shane.
FF likes to send air through his nose's tubes in a mirthless burst, a kind of anti-laugh. His nose is large and cucumber-shaped and wide-pored, and pretty much its whole circulatory system is visible.
Lenny Kubitz calls me and describes the thing blow by blow job. Says I should see the other guys. Says about breaking a Hawaiian's nose, shoving the bits up into the brain. The old chop and stiff arm, he says. Big Don G's a satanically tough motherfuck. This was his assessment. Said the way he heard it, you could fight like you was born in a bar fight. I tell Glennie, I say, I'm sure you'll be proud to hear him say it.
Gately was trying with maddening, sinistral care to write out, hurt? Dead any? Finest? Who hat in hall? More like drawing than writing, when without warning, one of the day shift trauma MDs sweeps in, radiating brisk health and painless cheer. Gately remembers dealing with this one MD some days ago in a kind of gray post-surgical fog. This MD is Indian or Pakistani and is glossily dark but with a sort of weirdly, classically white-type face you could easily imagine profiling on a coin, plus teeth you could read by the gleam of. Gately hates him.
So, I am here with you again in this room, the MD sings, kind of, when he talks.
The name in gold piping on his white coat has a D and a K and a shitload of vowels. Gately almost had to reach up and swat this MD after surgery to keep him from hooking up a Demerol drip. That was between, let's say, 4 and 8 days ago. It's probably but for the grace that his crocodilian sponsor, Ferocious Francis G's, sitting here, watching blandly when the Pakistani MD sweeps in this time. Plus, they all have this flourishy MD way of sweeping Gately's chart up off their hip and holding it up to read it. The Pakistani purses his lips and puffs them out absently and sucks off his pen a little.
Grade 2 toxemia. Synovial inflammation. The pain of the trauma is very much worse today, yes?
The MD says to the chart. He looks up. The teeth emerge.
Synovial inflammation. Nasty, nasty. The pain of synovial inflammation is compared in the medical literature to renal calculus, an ectopic labor.
Partly it's the darkness of the classic face around them that makes the teeth seem so high-watt. The smile widens steadily without seeming to run out of new teeth to expose.
And so you are now ready to let us provide the level of analgesia the trauma warrants, instead of Toradol, simple headache ibuprofen. Which these medications are boys doing a large man's duty here, yes? There has been reconsidering in light of the level, yes?
Gately is inscribing an enormous vowel in the notebook with incredible care.
I make you aware of synthetic antipyretic analgesics which are no higher than category C3 for dependence.
354.
Gately imagines the MD smiling incandescently as he wields a shepherd's crook. The guy has that odd, clipped, sing-song way of talking, of skinny guys in loincloths on mountains and films. Gately superimposes a big skull and crossbones over the glossy face, mentally. He holds up a palsied, page-high letter A and brandishes it at the MD, and then brings the notebook back down and swiftly up again. Spells it out, figuring Ferocious Francis will step in and set this ad man for the disease straight once and for all. So Gately will never have to face this kind of Pakistani temptation again, with maybe nobody supportive here next time. C3 his ass. Fucking tall one C3 too.
Oromorph SR for an instance. Very safe. Very much relief. Fast relief.
This is just morphine sulfate with a fancy corporate name, Gately knows.
This rackhead doesn't know who he's dealing with or what he's.
Now, I must tell. I would make the personal first choice of titrated hydromorphone hydrochloride in this case.
Christ, this is Delauded. Blues. Fackleman's Mount Doom. Kites, steep angle decline as well. Death on a Ritz, the Blue Bayou. Gene Fackleman's killer, by and large. And also Gately Pictures' good old Nooch. Tall, skinny Vinnie Nucci, from the beach at Salem, who favored Delauded, and spent over a year without ever taking the belt off his wing, dropping through Osco skylights at night on a rope with the belt all tight and ready just over his elbow already. Nucci never eating and getting skinnier and skinnier until he seemed to be just two cheekbones raised to a great silent height, even the whites of his eyes finally turning the blue of the bayou. And Fackleman's eliminated map after the insane scam on Sorkin and a disastrous two nights of Delauded, when Sorkin'd,
"Though I say yes, this in truth is a suitable medication, and I wish to respect all wishes and concerns,"
the MD half sings, inclined at the waist now by Gately's railings, looking closely at the shoulder's dressing, but not seeming at all disposed to even touch it, his hands behind his back. His ass is more or less right in ferocious Francis's face, who's just sitting there. The MD doesn't even seem to be aware. 34 years sober, ferocious Francis is there. And Francis isn't making a peep. It also occurs to Gately that esoteric is another ghost word he's got no rights to throw around, mentally.
"For I am Muslim, and abstain also by religious law from all abusive compounds as well," the MD says. "Yet if I have suffered trauma, or the dentist of my teeth proposes to perform a painful process, I submit as a Muslim to the imperative of my pain, and will accept relief, knowing no established religion's God wills needless suffering for his children."
Gately has made two shaky smaller A's together on the next sheet and is stabbing emphatically at the sheet with his bick. He wishes if the MD wouldn't shut up, he'd at least move, so Gately could shoot a desperate, "Please jump in here," look at ferocious Francis. The drug question has nothing to do with established gods. The MD's bobbing a little as he leans, his face coming in and then receding.
"This is a grade 2 trauma we are looking at in this room. Allow me to explain that the discomfort of right now will only intensify as the synovial nerves begin to reanimate. The laws of trauma dictate that the pain will intensify as healing begins to commence. I am a professional at my job, sir, as well as a Muslim. Hydrocodone bitartrate.
355.
C3. Levorphanol tartrate.
356.
C3. Oxymorphone hydrochloride.
357.
Admittedly, yes, C2. But more than indicated in this degree of needless suffering.
Gately can hear ferocious Francis blowing his nose again behind the MD. Gately's mouth floods with spittle at the memory of the sick, sweet, antiseptic taste of hydrochloride that rises to the tongue with an injection of Demerol. The taste, kite, and the lesbian burglars, and even Equus, "I'll stick anything in any part of my body," Reese, all gagged at. But that poor old Nooch and Gene Fackleman and Gately himself had loved, came to love like a mother's warm hand. Gately's eyes wobble and his tongue protrudes from a shiny mouth corner as he draws a crude syringe in arm and belt and then tries to draw skull and bones over the whole shaky ensemble. But the skull looks more like a plain old smiley face. He holds it out to the foreigner anyway. The dextral pain's so bad he wants to throw up, throat tube or no. The MD studies the palsied drawing, nodding the exact way Gately used to nod at Alfonso Porrias Carbo, the totally un-understandable Cuban.
"Oxycodone naloxone compound with a short half-life.
358.
But only a C3 grading of abuse."
There's no way the guy could be, like, intentionally making his voice this wheedly sounding. It's got to be Gately's own disease. The spider. Gately envisions his brain struggling in a silk cocoon. He keeps summoning to mind the little detox story ferocious Francis tells from the commitment podium, how they gave him Librium to help with the discomfort of withdrawal.
359.
And how Francis says He just threw the Librium hard over his left shoulder, for luck, and has had very good luck ever since.
Likewise as well, the time-tested pentazocine lactate, which I can offer with assurances, as a Muslim trauma professional standing here in this room in person with you at your bed's side.
Pentazocine lactate is Tolwyn, Gately's number two trusted standard when he was out there, which 120 milligrams on an empty gut was like floating in oil, the exact same temperature as your body, just like Percocet.
360.
Except without the maddening back-of-the-eyeball itch that always wrecked a Percocet high for him.
Surrender your courageous fear of dependence and let us do our profession, young sir,
the Pakistani sums up, standing right up next to the bed, the left side, his professional lab coat hiding FF, hands behind his back, the dull glint of the metal corner of Gately's chart just visible between his legs, immaculate of posture, smiling cheerily down, the whites of his eyes as ungodly white as his teeth. The memory of Tolwyn makes parts of his body, Gately didn't know could drool, drool. He knows what's coming next, Gately does. And if the Pakistani goes ahead and offers Demerol again, Gately won't resist. And who the fuck will be able to blame him, after all? Why should he have to resist? He'd received a bona fide grade whatever dextral synovial trauma. Shot with a professionally modified 44 item. He's post-trauma, in terrible pain, and everyone heard the guy say it. It was going to get worse, the pain. This was a trauma pro in a white coat here, making reassurances of legitimate fucking use. Gehaney heard him. What the fuck did the flaggers want from him? This wasn't hardly like slipping over to unit number 7 with a syringe and a bottle of Visine. This was a stop-term measure. A short-gap-type measure. The probable intervention of a compassionate, unjudging God. A quick prescription squirt of Demerol. Probably at the outside. 2-3 days of a Demerol drip. Maybe even one where they'd hook the drip to a rubber bulb he could hold and self-administer the Demerol only as needed. Maybe it was the disease itself telling him to be scared. A medically necessary squirt would pull all his old triggers again. Put him back in the cage. Gately pictures himself trying to shunt through a magnetic contact burglar alarm with a hand and a hook. But surely if ferocious Francis thought a medically advised short-term squirt suspect at all, the old reptilian bastard would say something. Do his fucking job as a crocodile and sponsor, instead of just sitting there playing with his nostrils' little non-invasive tube.
Look, kid, I'm gonna screw and let you settle this bullshit and come back up later,
comes Francis's voice, subdued and neutral, signifying nothing. And then the rasp of the chair's legs and the system of grunts that always accompanies FF's getting up from a chair. His white crew cut rises like a slow moon over the Pakistani shoulder, which the MD's only sign of acknowledgement of Francis is to sort of tuck his chin down into his shoulder like a violinist addressing Gately's sponsor for the first time.
Then perhaps you would please, Mr. Gately Sr., if you please help us. Help your concerned and brave boy here, but a boy I believe whose cavalier attitude underestimates the level of coming discomfort, which is sadly unnecessary, altogether, if he will let us help him, sir.
The Pakistani sings over his shoulder to Ferocious Francis, as if they were the room's only adults. He's assuming Ferocious Francis is Gately's organic dad. Gately knows a crocodile never bothers to correct anybody's misimpression. He's halfway to the door, moving with maddening slow care like always, as if walking on ice, twisted and seeming to limp off both legs, and heart-breakingly assless in the baggy, seat-shiny, wide-wailed old man's corduroys he always wears, the back of his red neck complexly creased as he moves off away, lifting one hand in a gesture of acknowledgement and dismissal of the MD's request.
Not my business to say one way or the other. Kid's gonna do what he decides he needs to do for himself. He's the one that's feeling it. He's the only one can decide.
He either pauses or slows down even further at the open door, looking back at Gately, but not meeting his wide eyes.
You keep your pecker up, kid,
and I'll bring some of the son-of-a-bitches by to look in again later.
He slips in.
Might want to ask for some help deciding.
The last of this comes from the White Hall, as the Pakistani's glossy head comes back in close, with now a tight, strained patient smile, and Gately can hear him inhaling to get ready to say that, of course, in grade 2 traumas of this severe type, the treatment of preferred indication is the admittedly C2 and highly abusable but unsurpassed for effectiveness and tightly controlled administration of 1 50 milligram tab in a diluting saline drip quarterly, 3 to 4 hours of MEP. Gately's good left hand skins a knuckle, shooting out between the bars of the bedside crib railing and plunging under the MD's lab coat and fastening onto the guy's balls and bearing down. The Pakistani pharmacologist screams like a woman. It isn't rage or the will to harm, so much as just no other ideas for keeping the bastard from offering something Gately knows that he's powerless at this moment to refuse. The sudden exertion sends a blue-green sheet of pain over Gately that makes his eyes roll up as he bears down on the balls, but not enough to crush. The Pakistani curtsies deeply and bends forward, crumpling around Gately's hand, showing all 112 teeth as he screams higher and higher until he hits a jagged high note, like a big opera lady in a Viking helmet, so shattering it makes the crib railings and window glass shiver, and woke Don Gately up with a start, his left arm through the railing and twisted with the force of his attempt to sit up, so that the pain now made him hit almost the same high note as the dream's foreign MD. The sky outside the window was gorgeous, dilaudid colored. The room was full of serious AM light, no sleet on the window. The ceiling throbbed a little but did not breathe. The one visitor chair was back over by the wall. He looked down. Either the stenographer's notebook and pen had got knocked off his bed, or the dream had made up that part too. The next bed was still empty and made up tight. It came to him all of a sudden why they called them hospital corners. But the railing Joel Van D had folded down to sit on the bunk, in the fucking Erdetti kid sweats, was still folded down, and the other railing was still up. So there was some, like, evidence of the one part, that she'd been really there, showing him the pictures. Gately brought his skinned hand gingerly back inside the railing, and felt to make sure there really was a big invasive tube going into his mouth, and there was. He could roll his eyes way up and see his heart monitor going silently nuts. Sweat was coming off every part of him, and for the first time in the trauma wing, he felt like he needed to take a shit. And he had no idea what arrangements there were for taking a shit, but suspected they weren't going to be appetizing at all. Second, he tried to abide. No single second was past enduring. The intercom was giving triple dings. There really were sounds of other rooms' TPs, and of a meal cart being rolled down the hall, and the metally smell of food for the edible patients. He couldn't see anything like a hat shadow in the hall, but it could have been all the sunlight. The dream's vividness had been either fever or disease, but either way, it had fucking seriously rattled his cage. He heard the sing-song voice promising about increasing discomfort. His shoulder beat like a big heart, and the pain was sickeninger than ever. No single second was past standing. Memories of good old Demerol rose up, clamoring to be entertained. The thing in Boston AA is they try to teach you to accept occasional cravings, the sudden thoughts of the substance. They tell you that sudden substance cravings will rise unbidden in a true addict's mind like bubbles in a toddler's bath. It's a lifelong disease. You can't keep the thoughts from popping in there. The thing they try to teach you is just to let them go. The thoughts. Let them come as they will, but do not entertain them. No need to invite a substance, thought, or memory in. Offer it a tonic in your favorite chair and chat with it about old times. The thing about Demerol wasn't just the womb-warm buzz of a serious narcotic. It was more like the, what, the aesthetics of the buzz. Gately'd always found Demerol, with a slight Tolwyn kicker, such a smooth and orderly buzz. A somehow deliciously symmetrical buzz. The mind floats, easy in the exact center of a brain, that floats cushioned in a warm skull, that itself sits perfectly centered on a cushion of soft air, some necklace distance above the shoulders, and inside all is a somnolent hum. Chest rises and falls on its own, far away. The easy squeak of your head's blood is like bedsprings in the friendly distance. The sun itself seems to be smiling. And when you nod off, you sleep like a man of wax, and awaken in the same last position you remember falling asleep in. And pain of all sorts becomes a theory, a news item in the distant colder climes, way below the warm air you hum on. And what you feel is mostly gratitude at your abstract distance from anything that doesn't sit inside concentric circles, and love what's happening. Gailey takes advantage of the fact that he's already facing ceilingward to seriously ask for help with the obsession. He thinks hard about anything else at all. Heading out with old Gary Carty in the pre-dawn reek of low tide off Beverly to bring up lobster traps. The MP and the flies. His mother sleeping slack-mouthed on a chintz divan. Cleaning the very grossest corner of the Shattuck shelter. The billow of the veiled girl's veil. The trap's little cages of cross-hatched bars. The lobster's eyes stalks, always poking through the squares so the eyes looked out at open sea. Or the bumper stickers on the MP's old Ford. See ya! And, don't tailgate me or I'll flick a booger on your windshield. And, MIA, forgotten. And, I haven't had sex in so long I forget who gets tied up. The fish asking about what's water. The sharp-nosed, round-cheeked, dead-eyed nurse with a weird Germanish accent that would sell Gately little sampler bottles of Sanofi Winthrop Demerol syrup, 80 milligrams a bottle, vilely banana-flavored, then would lie back, slack and dead-eyed, while Gately X'd her, barely breathing, in an airless Ipswich apartment whose weird brown window shades filled the place with light the color of weak tea. Named Egeda, or Egety. She eventually started telling Gately she couldn't come close to coming unless he burned her with a cigarette, which marked the first time Gately seriously tried to quit smoking. Now a black outside linebacker of a St. E's nurse rumbles in and checks his drips and writes on his chart and points the artillery of her tits down at him to ask how he's doing and calls him baby, which nobody minds from enormous black nurses. Gately points at his lower abdomen in the area of his colon and tries to make a broad, explosive gesture with just one arm, slightly less mortified than if it had been a human-sized white nurse, at least. Gately happened onto Demerol at age 23, when intraocular itching finally forced him to abandon Percocets and explore new vistas. Demerol was more expensive, milligram for milligram, than most synthetic narcs, but it was also easier to get, being the treatment of medical choice for mind-bending post-operative pain. Gately can't for the life of him remember who or just where in Salem he was first introduced to what the boys on the North Shore called Pebbles and Bam Bam, 50 and 100 milligram Demerol tablets, respectively very tiny and tiny, chalky white scored discs with D/35 on one side, and Sanofi Winthrop Company's very soon-beloved trademark, a kind of W on the other, that rakish W just puncturing the square envelope of itchy-eyed North Shore life. And remembering even the D/35 feels like entertaining the obsession. He knows it was not long after Nooch's funeral because he'd been alone and crewless at whatever moment whoever handed him 2 50-milligram tablets, way too tiny for his big-fingered hands, in lieu of whatever else it was he'd wanted, laughing when Gately said, "What the fuck?" and "They look like bufferin for ants or some shit," saying, "Trust me." It must have been his 23rd summer out there, because he remembers being shirtless and driving down 93 when he ran out of everything else and pulled off into the JFK library lot to take them. So small and tasteless, he had to check his open mouth in the rear view to make sure he'd gotten them down.